Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Maron to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Maron at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com. Good afternoon, good morning, good evening. Wherever you are in the world, I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
Now tell me, how are you, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling technical.
Oh, good.
Because the last few weeks has just been crazy in the art news.
For the last few days.
And also the mainstream news, because everything's got quite technical, hasn't it? And
it has.
Unless you are tech savvy, which I'm not really. I mean, I'm kind of half tech savvy.
You're bi savvy, bi tech.
Yeah, but what?
Bisexual.
Anyway. No, I'm actually gay.
Are you?
But yes. Yeah. But there's Whoa. Been the emergence of NFTs, which are non-fungible tokens into the mainstream, which is something that our guest today has been predicting for many years. And he happens to be a great friend of ours.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought we would be quite, on the pulse and quite like art newsy and do an episode dedicated to this recent phenomenon to try and work out what it all means, because we are a bit confused and we want to be educated as much as we can. And hopefully it's going to help our listeners learn as well.
Yes.
And this guest is an amazing curator. He's an amazing art advisor. He's been a supporter of artists for a long, long time. He's put on shows like the first ever show of artists that I love, like Michael Armitage.
Yes.
And also exhibitions about queer art in the UK.
Absolutely.
And he's a real champion of art, but also kind of queer art. And he's just a wonderful human being. And has even hung out with us here in Margate on the few occasions which he's come here, and I remember some wonderful evenings we've had here. So yeah, he's a great friend of ours, and I've actually always wanted him on Talk Art, and this is the perfect opportunity to also explore his career. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art Simon Oldfield. Hi, hello. Simon.
Hi, guys.
So where are you today?
Chat. I'm in London. Oh, and you're in Margate.
I thought you were going to say LA, because I know that you're often in Los Angeles a lot.
I miss LA so much. I can't wait to get on a flight and be there again. See all my friends and feel the sun on my face and all those things, like everyone else.
Absolutely. It's a bit sunny today, though. It's been nice today.
It has been very nice today.
Yes.
Right.
Anyway, weather aside, you have come on as our resident nifty expert. Now, everybody listening, you may or may not know, you may have followed this, as Rob was saying, that this phenomenon has entered from the art world echelons into mainstream media, because what's happened in the last couple of days is that one of these digital artworks, which are called NFTs, as Rob said, non-fungible tokens, which we will explain, went on to Christie's as the first time that a digital artwork was being auctioned. It started at $100 and it rapidly went up, and the last 2 days it sold for $69.3 million. Now, this is a work made by an artist whose real name is Mike Winkleman. He's a graphic designer, but he goes under the name Beeple. And we are here to talk about this phenomenon, but what this means for the art world as a whole. And we're coming to Simon Oldfield, who is actually an expert, because you won a national competition with your writings on this many years ago.
I did. That was a very long time ago. It was, I think, almost 20 years ago, maybe just over 20 years. It was a dissertation I wrote as part of my law degree, so you know, even when I was an undergrad. And I revisited it quite recently when all of this started to kind of kick off, thinking, you know, this. Let's just see where, you know, what ideas were discussed in there that maybe has resonance for today. And it's amazing actually how you translate, how you think about it, how these things translate through the years and then become something, and the whole world sort of picks up and carry. It becomes a much larger thing than you ever first predicted. But it's the ideas that were discussed all those years ago with me that have become so significant now. And so, yeah, I did. I examined it all those years ago, won an award for my dissertation. I had professors and all these people telling me that they had no idea what really the internet was going to do and why was it really relevant and why did we need to really examine this in any particular way, and was it sort of looking for solutions to a problem that didn't really exist? And of course, all that is kind of history now, because we know that these things have, you know, they become not just fundamental to the like legal world, but to everyone and every aspect of our lives. You know, that particular dissertation was looking at the interaction between intellectual property and the internet, you know, the internet being a global system, of course, that we all understand today, but you know, the laws that apply are jurisdictional. So it was looking at, you know, how do those two things interact with each other? Where do they come into conflict? And how do you resolve those things? And at the time, there was a lot of debate around domain names and how domain names would interact with trademarks specifically. And, you know, there were lots of cases around sort of cyber squatting and people who were just, you know, competing interests. So two different facets, those things. Some things were done, you know, with maybe some negative intention or for the intention to kind of to claim, you know, kind of a ransom, I suppose, from companies that own trademarks. Or there might be two companies with two trademarks registered in different countries or for different goods and services. So Apple, for example, multiple trademarks with Apple in the trademark, but actually only one registered Apple.com. It happens to be, you know, the computers that we all use, but actually could have been any of the other competing interests. All of that's been resolved in many ways, you know, through the courts, through legislation, through different countries are taking slightly different approaches. And you have the DNS system. So domain names are a centralized system. So there's a .com and all the other ways that you can denote a website. But those things have largely been resolved, and trademark law has been reconciled with the way that domain names operate. But now we're kind of having similar conversations around NFTs, around cryptocurrency, around the way that decentralized computer systems and networks operate, because it's changing the way that, you know, so fundamentally it's changing the way that we all operate, the way that we interact, and our concepts of what it means to regulate any particular environment. So, you know, the whole premise of a decentralized network is that everything is done by a series of computers on the blockchain. It is by nature not centralized. So there is not one individual body, there's not one individual person or organization or government that is taking any of this, any control over any of these things, and is not therefore able to control any of it. So what's interesting is that you're going to have, you know, legally there are so many different structures that need to come into play, because all the contracts that are being executed to produce an NFT are built on the blockchain, and those blockchain contracts exist forever. Once they are created, they exist forever, and they are legally binding upon those parties. But there's not one individual person that keeps track of all of those things. So it's a decentralized system for something which is, you know, now attracting huge amounts of value and attention.
Yeah.
So something that sold yesterday with Beeple was sold for, you know, $69.4 million, almost $70 million. And it's based obviously on a contract, and it's an NFT that's been issued as a token, a non-fungible token. And maybe we need to talk about what that actually
is. Yeah, let's break these all down here. So you're basically an internet prophet, and you're like a wunderkind, and you could spot all this happening like Blade Runner. You were there at the forefront. But so let's just go back and really do this NFT for dummies.
Also cryptocurrencies. Can you explain that as well?
Yeah, and Bitcoin. I mean, but we, there's got a lot of people out there that are like frustrated at this, trying to understand, wanting to understand, wanting to jump on it. Like, how do I make these? How do I buy these? How do I make all this money suddenly? Because it feels like there is all this money suddenly being made, and everybody who doesn't understand it is getting like scratching at the door to get in.
Do you know, I hear the excitement in your voice, actually. It's just like, it's a bit how I was thinking when I first started, you know, thinking about what we're going to say on here. There's so much to say, there's so much to discuss, and you want to get it all out in the first 30 seconds. And of course, it's actually really complex, and there's a lot, there are many different layers to it, and you want to explain it, break it all down, but then you think, well, where do you start with that? Because, you know, there is a lot to discuss. Okay, so let's start with, should we start with cryptocurrency? Because that's kind of where it all began, actually.
Yeah, that's what I thought, yeah.
So cryptocurrency is essentially the currency that is used to trade NFTs, but it's also the currency that's used to trade on many other these DeFi networks. So, you know, through the Ethereum network or any other network. Ether is, oh crikey, I'm complicating it from already.
What's DeFi and Ethereum?
Let's start with Bitcoin. Bitcoin was created in 2009. It's a limited number of Bitcoins that can ever be mined, created as a and that limit is 21 million. So they are described in some respects as being, you know, some people describe them as, in the simplest way, liquid gold, because there's a finite amount of Bitcoin that can ever be produced.
Oh, right.
Currently in existence, there are about, I think it's 18.4 million roughly that are in circulation, have been mined already today. So there's been quite a, yeah, that's quite quick mining. If you look over the last 9 to 10 years, they've mined 18.4 million.
When you say mined, why can't they just press a button and create it? Why is it something that it's like literally they're digging out gold when it's an algorithm?
They are literally digging out gold, but through computers. And that's where all the kind of environmental aspects come in, because there's a huge amount of energy that is used to mine these Bitcoins, because it takes a whole, you know, banks and banks of computers and servers and power to generate this mining process. So for each block of Bitcoins, they are mined and placed onto a block on the blockchain. And every time you're mining a Bitcoin, in the simplest terms, you have to use a lot of energy to make all the codes connect. I think that's the best way to describe it. And initially, when it was being produced, it was easier to do it. There were high rewards for some of the miners, so it was all being done very swiftly. And so, you know, there were quite a lot of Bitcoins produced very early on, and that process is slowing down. It's built into the system to slow down. It's kind of described as a way to manage the inflation of Bitcoin. Every so often, periodically, the number of Bitcoin per block halves. So actually what's interesting, even though we've got to 18.4 million Bitcoins currently in the circulation, it's going to take us to about 2140 to mine the remaining Bitcoin, the 3.5 million Bitcoin. So we've got a whole load of time between now and then before we will actually have all Bitcoin.
Who decided though, Simon?
So it's written into the code. It's written into the protocol. It can, you know, unless the protocol
has
changed.
Who wrote that?
Who built the code?
Who wrote the code and built the code? Who said, right, I'm writing this code for these coins. We're going to mine them. It's going to take this long. We can only do 21 million. We're never making any more after that. That's it.
Yeah, exactly. So it was basically by Satoshi. He wrote the code, or well, everyone assumes it's a he. It actually might not be a he. It's anonymous. It's assumed potentially that it's a man in his 40s of Japanese heritage. Actually, we don't really know. And there are claims. There's an Australian guy who claims to be the person who wrote the code, but no one really knows for sure. So you can fractionalize a Bitcoin now, and you can own part of a Bitcoin, which is like a Satoshi. And those are, you know, I'm not a crypto expert, so, you know, forgive me if I get any of this phrasing wrong, but, you know, basically this is what we're talking about. So you can buy a part of a Bitcoin. So you could own, you know, a percentage of one, or, you know, a very small.
Like a Trivial Pursuit cheese.
Yeah, like a Trivial Pursuit cheese, or like a little bit of coinage in your pocket.
Yeah, or like 10p or 5p.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. That's the way to think of it.
Okay.
And so it's written into the code as the base code that it can only ever be 21 million of these produced, which is why everyone's getting so excited about it, because it's finite. So, you know, no one can really, I mean, theoretically, I suppose anything could be changed, but, you know, the idea is that it can't be changed, and that it will, once you reach the 21 million, that's it. And because it's getting harder and harder to mine those remaining Bitcoins, it's the value is going up. And also there are a whole other load of factors playing into it. There's institutional buyers, there are corporate buyers, there are loads of retail buyers piling into the Bitcoin space, and arguably that's what's pushing up the price. And interestingly, today, just before we came onto air to talk about this, it hit a new record. It smashed through $60,000 per Bitcoin, which is the first time it's ever done that. It's just dipped below that again literally right now I'm looking at my screen, but it's...
Wow.
How much would they have been to buy in the first place?
Oh, they were like, you know, nothing. A few hundred dollars or less than that. But, you know, they wow. remained quite low for quite a long time.
And is there a limit?
Even last year, they were very, very low. So the rise has been very rapid, particularly in the last 12 months. And arguably people say, you know, the way that the pandemic has operated and unfolded and the way the economy has really shifted and the way that we all interact with each other is part of the reason why Bitcoin has risen so much.
Yes.
Well, cash, you can't touch cash at the minute. So all the thing is like you can only use credit card or you can tap your phone when you're buying food at the supermarket. Cash is like passing on the virus. So obviously you want to get rid of that. So keep it as much as that. Is there a limit to how many you can buy? Is there like something, or could someone theoretically own all 21 million Bitcoins eventually?
I don't think that'd be possible now. I think it'd be like, you know, like not everybody could own, not one single person could own every single bar of gold in the world.
Okay.
But, you know, I suppose theoretically it's possible, but it's such a remote possibility. I just don't think that would happen. But I you know, and I don't think there is a limit on how much any individual could own, apart from the fact the limits on what's available and what's actually in circulation. So what a lot of people are doing at the moment is they are literally taking off their Bitcoin from circulation. And the problem at the moment, you can't really use it for very much. You know, so it's largely seen as a store of value. So people are, you know, buying Bitcoin, they're holding Bitcoin, but they're not really doing very much with it apart from either trading Bitcoin or holding it. Because, you know, we can't walk into Sainsbury's or Starbucks and use our Bitcoin to buy anything.
Yet.
And that's the key, yet. You know, there's lots of talk about what you might be able to do with it in the future. Tesla saying that they will be accepting Bitcoin. You know, there are PayPal are talking about being able to accept Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. You know, there are whole areas of the economy which are beginning to look at this. And, you know, it's only a matter of time, I would say, before major institutions and corporations are accepting Bitcoin as you know, part of their payment structure. And, you know, Uber said, for example, they're not going to buy
it. Some people in the art world.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Some people in the art world completely. And, you know, like actually looking at Beeple, that was bought with cryptocurrency. It wasn't bought with Bitcoin. It was bought with Ether, which is another cryptocurrency seen as it's the second largest.
How many cryptos are there?
Oh, there are loads and they keep growing as well. But, you know, I think they all do slightly different things. They all seek to kind of solve different problems, different solutions. So for example, Ether exists because it is the currency that's linked to the Ethereum network. Now, the Ethereum network, you know, the technology is what a lot of these NFTs are built on. And it fits into this decentralized system as well. So therefore, it makes sense for Ether to be the currency that is used to transact with these NFTs and any other, you know, whether it's artwork or any other kind of NFT. So Bitcoin is kind of was the first and is, you know, seen as liquid gold, seen as the gold standard. Who knows where it will end up? And it's probably a subject for a whole nother conversation. But there are all these other cryptocurrencies which are doing interesting things as well. And Ether is not limited in the same way that Bitcoin is, which is, you know, arguably why people say it won't ever get to the level of Bitcoin, but it does something different. You know, it operates in a different way. And there's a new there's an update coming to Ether and Ethereum, actually, the underlying technology in July-ish this year. It's just been announced. And that changes the way that it's structured. It actually addresses some of the environmental and climate issues, and it changes the transaction fees, which makes it more affordable for people to use. Because actually, trading in crypto at the moment is quite expensive. You know, there are lots of individual transaction fees. They're called gas fees in Ethereum, in Ether, for example. So each individual miner to make a contract binding to come together costs Ether, basically. It costs a gas fee. And all of that's expensive. And that's all changing. And that will make, I think, come July, August, it will again change the way that this market operates. Because at the moment, it's so complicated.
Yes.
I mean, you've got to be really tech savvy to understand this. You've got to be able to, you've got to be kind of aware of what you're stepping into. It feels, you know, quite mind-boggling, to be quite honest. And I think that there's a real danger that will you know, lead to some really unintended consequences, people stepping into things and not quite knowing what they're really signing up for. At the same time, I think it has a revolutionary quality that could completely change everything, you know, way beyond the art world, but certainly within the art world, in a way that we've never really kind of anticipated, and certainly not even today what we're anticipating. So I think it could, I think the potential is enormous, but we've got to resolve probably quite a lot of the issues and break it down for people. And even then, I still don't think it's very straightforward, because if I gave you a 5-point guide as to how you create an NFT as an artist and another 5-point guide about how you acquire an NFT as a collector, I still don't think it'd be that easy for someone to actually do it, which is why all my clients are like, oh, we really want to do this, but how do we do it? And it's complex, and you've got to, and there are lots of legal aspects to it, which I don't think have been fully resolved yet. And certainly, even if they have been resolved, they haven't been tested in the, you know, in the courts or in any kind of, or through legislation even.
That's so interesting. So that's what I wanted to talk to you about, as well as the idea of like the regulations and kind of the legalities of it all, because I know we haven't got to the art part yet, but I did talk to an artist about it the other day, and she sent me loads of different comments to do with it. And some of them were to do with this idea, allegedly, obviously, that this whole kind of universe, this new radical rebel kind of system, could be used for like money laundering or avoiding like financial regulation or sort of normal regulated kind of punishments that can happen, you know, with US banking or investment or stocks and shares. And that they were saying to me that this idea of NFTs actually threatens artists as well. And it's a fascinating kind of, so that I didn't really totally understand why, but it's so interesting. I don't know if you know more on that. But
I think it's, I agree with you. There's been a lot of criticism of cryptocurrencies because of its potential use by money launderers, criminals, and a whole host of other, you know, unsavory purposes. And because of its nature, it is, because it's decentralized, because the ability to be able to use it and acquire it and hold it in a either anonymous or pseudonymous way,
yes,
it masks the ownership of a lot of these things. And that is a problem. And it has been criticized by, you know, people who don't want to use it for those reasons. They see all the good benefits for it, all the upsides of cryptocurrency and decentralized networking. Those are all fantastic, but you kind of have to resolve, you have to resolve all of the other negative sides of it. So, you know, if you take, you know, the kind of criminal and the money laundering aspects of it, you know, proceeds for terrorism and all these other things, which are just, you know, kind of horrific to think that you might even be swimming in the same waters as those people. But actually, There are efforts to be made, and you know, to tidy all that up, to clean it up. And there are certain platforms where they're exchanges for these cryptocurrencies, which are working very hard, working in tandem with the regulators and with governments to ensure that all the standard, to apply all the sort of money laundering checks that you'd expect in any kind of financial banking or any other financial system, in any kind of major transaction, whether it's art or anything else. And so some of the ones that are doing that very well, there's one here called CoinFloor, which is based in the UK. And there's another one called Coinbase in the US. Coinbase is probably the biggest. And they're looking to float as a exchange. That's where people go and they exchange, they acquire and they sell Bitcoin and any other cryptocurrency. And they're working really hard to clean up the whole area, I suppose, and address the concerns that were raised by the artists you spoke to. And I hope that that is resolved, because otherwise it threatens to undermine the entire system, and it will then undermine the potential for it. So it's really important.
And one quick question. So you can have more than one more than one cryptocurrency. So you can have like all these different companies making this cryptocurrency. So whether it be that supposed, alleged, whatever the word is, Japanese, you know, developer who created
Banksy of the crypto world.
Yeah, Banksy of the cryptocurrency world. The guy called, who did Bitcoin, Satoshi. So you are able to have more than one. So in a way, it's a bit like having Apple versus PC
or pound versus euro, isn't it? Or like, you know, the lira and the drachma and the
It is, exactly. I think some of them, so I suppose, seek to operate like a fiat currency, like a currency for a fiat currency is a national currency, so like the US dollar, British pound. And so some of them seek to operate in that way, I suppose. And there are cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, and then there are others that, like stable coins, are tethered to a fixed asset like the dollar or any other fixed asset to kind of create, to try and remove some of the volatility that you see within the cryptocurrency world. So Bitcoin, for example, can you know, swing by 10% in any one day or lose potentially 50% of its value over several days, which is why, you know, there are lots of warnings saying, you know, you really should not be investing in this unless you can afford to do it. And, you know, and I think it's sort of a fair, obviously it's a very fair comment to make sure that people know what they're doing and what they're stepping into, because there's every risk that your principal investment could be lost. But to your point, Rob, yeah, absolutely. You could, as an individual, hold multiple different cryptocurrencies, and there are multiple ones out there, and they're all operated by different people, and they have different organizations. They have different functions. So, for example, there's a lot of games, for example, and game environments that, or virtual worlds like Decentraland and these sort of things.
It feels like Ready Player One. You ever read that novel or seen that movie where they're all they basically just log into this world and you have your virtual life. You hear about these stories of, you know, families who in real life neglect their kids because in this virtual life they're like kings and queens of this village they've set up. It's like this absolute virtual existence, it feels like we're going into.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's you can use certain cryptocurrencies in that way. They only, you go into these virtual worlds and they have their own cryptocurrencies that allow you to trade within that environment. So it's, you know, whether it's buying a skin for your avatar, whether it's buying, you know, beauty products for your avatar, whether it's buying a piece of virtual land or whatever it might be. And those have their own little cryptocurrencies that may or may not have a value or a use outside of that environment. But Bitcoin is seeking to operate, you know, outside in the real world. I think that's what's different about it.
Something that I find really confusing, though, is in my gut when I hear about all this, I've always heard about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies prior to the whole art world involvement in the last few weeks that we've, you know, has come to our attention. I've always heard about it from very wealthy individuals. So people that are either art advisors who are working with super wealthy individuals or multi-millionaires, I would say even billionaires. You know, in the art world, we have access at times to these very wealthy individuals. And it's often from those sources that I've heard about Bitcoin. And I've never been anything to do with any cryptocurrency because I don't understand it. So is there a kind of weird thing about this whole cryptocurrency that's quite inaccessible to the everyday person? It doesn't seem that
Is
it designed to sort of create wealth for wealthy people, which in turn would mean that it's quite an imbalance of power?
I think that it definitely has that risk. And I think there are two aspects to it. So I suppose from a cryptocurrency perspective, yes, there is, you know, right now to buy a Bitcoin, you've got to have around $60,000 sitting around to buy one Bitcoin, you know, and that's so therefore that is the preserve of, you know, very wealthy people. And you've got people like, you know, Elon Musk and other, you know, very wealthy billionaires who are either buying it personally or they're putting it onto their company balance sheets. And then you've got, you know, Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan, all these other massive financial institutions coming into the market and looking to acquire Bitcoin or any other cryptocurrency to sit on, you know, on behalf of their clients and maybe as a way of helping to regulate the system, but certainly getting involved with it, in which I don't think it's quite clear how they're going to get involved, but they are getting involved. So certainly there is that element. But some of the cryptocurrencies, you can buy one Ripple, for example, for, you know, like the equivalent of 50 cents. So it's not, you know, it's not necessarily huge investment for every single one of those cryptocurrencies. And I think that what's also interesting is that cryptocurrency has become really popular in many jurisdictions and countries where their national currencies aren't particularly stable. So in South America and Africa and in different parts of the world where they can't necessarily rely on their own currency for remaining stable because of inflation or any other reason. So they are looking at cryptocurrency as a way of allowing them to transact and hold their currency in a more stable way. And at the same time, you've got people who haven't been able to have access to a bank account, been able to open up a crypto wallet and then hold a cryptocurrency. And so they are suddenly accessing a financial system which they couldn't previously access because they weren't able, didn't qualify to open up a bank account or whatever.
But what happens when you don't have access to a computer, say? What happens when you don't have access to the education to understand how cryptocurrency even works, which would cut out a huge proportion of society? And to me, it seems, even if you think about, I don't know, like I've been looking in the last few weeks because of the death of Sarah, the woman in London, like at intersectional feminism, for example, just on another topic. But it does kind of relate to this in the sense of, you know, social background, you know, like race, like all of these different issues that can impact your education access or you know, social
any
circumstances,
access, yeah.
Any access. And if you think about lockdown, where children at schools, even in here in Margate or London, who don't have an iPad or don't have a computer at home, that then weren't able to participate in education, like surely it isn't that equal as a system? It doesn't, I mean, even if the ideas are, it just seems quite odd.
I agree. And I think that it is, I think it presents all these problems and challenges. And, you know, and actually, if you look at how governments and central banks are trying to approach this, they are also looking at cryptocurrency and looking at how they regulate it and the challenges it presents to, you know, individuals and society as a whole, and also the way the government functions even. Because, you know, think about it, if you've got Bitcoin, let's say Bitcoin, take for the example, it becomes, you know, there are articles for people saying, oh, Bitcoin's going to suddenly flip over and it's going to become the default currency globally. You'd think, well, is it? I mean, maybe it will, maybe it won't, who knows? But what if, just say, in a kind of crazy world, it does.
Yeah.
What does that mean? What does that represent? Does that mean that, you know, because if a government can't control the main finance, the main currency that's operating within a country, you know, they can't control and pull the certain levers that they can ordinarily. They can't do what they're doing right now. They can't pull those, you know, those the way they can't, I suppose, kind of manage the way that people access funds and the way that companies are supported. And that, I think, challenges the very fabric of society. You know, if you can't tax in the way that you do at the moment because the currencies are not traced in the same way, then, you know, how do you allow society to function the way we all expect it to?
And to be honest, it's lasted longer than many critics of Bitcoin. It was almost seen as like comic in a way, like 5 years ago, say.
I just find it's like our generation with TikTok. It's like, I'm like, I don't get TikTok. And then I'm like, then everyone younger's like, you are an old nan. And I'm like, you don't get it. And I feel like, you know, we are kind of putting our feet going like, no, this shouldn't be happening. This isn't right. But then everyone younger is going, what are you talking about? This is the world now. We've grown up with the internet. You had an existence without internet. They don't know what that is. This is just normal. But for me, so let's get on to the art stuff now. So we've had a history of the Bitcoin, we've had a history of cryptocurrency. So that moves on. Now, for me, it feels like we've gone into this world now where these cryptocurrency Bitcoin things are numbers on screens, which really, in reality, is what we all work through bank accounts. We don't sit with cash under our beds anymore. Everything is kind of like just numbers on the screen. But these nifties, NFT, non-fungible tokens, which we'll explain what that means, for me, are visual bitcoins, are visual cryptocurrency that you buy this Bitcoin for $60,000, but with it, you get this image attached, which is unique to you. It can't, it's traced to you, it belongs to you. So that certifies or mints, as is a term, that Bitcoin to you. Am I on the right track with that?
You absolutely are. So, you know, you've got the non-fungible token, they've got two parts of it. Non-fungible means like, it's unique. It's the only thing which is, you know, it's the only one in existence. The token is the kind of the bit that says you own it.
Right.
So you've got the non-fungible token, and the artwork that points to exists actually somewhere else, but you've had it minted and then you buy it through one of these platforms like Nifty Gateway or OpenSea or Rarible
Maker's
or a whole
Place.
Host of others. Exactly. Foundation, Super Rare, there are a number of them, and there are more coming, I'm sure. And actually, the platforms and the interaction of the platforms, I think, is something we should come on to later. But that's exactly it. You're buying an NFT which represents your ownership of a particular digital artwork. And that artwork exists, you know, in a digital form. And it only exists in a digital form. I mean, you could have a real world manifestation of that.
Yeah, it's unique, isn't it?
It is unique.
Yeah.
Well, it is unique unless you choose for it not to be, and the artist chooses for it not to be, in the way that you could have a unique painting or you could have a limited edition. So there are two forms of, from a contract perspective, there are two forms of NFTs.
You got the original Andy Warhol, and then Andy Warhol made an edition of it. So you've got the original one, which is unique, can't be duplicated, but then he's chosen to duplicate it, but you know they're an edition, and then 300 people have access to that, and they're signed. And that's then exactly. They are...
signed and numbered, yeah.
Signed and numbered, and they are, they belong to you. But in this world, you know, like if we're talking about... You know, I'm sort of relating it to flipping art. So our collectors or people who get access to really hot young artists that they get at primary pricing, then they stick it straight in auction at secondary pricing and they get this money back. This feels like the online version of that. But it's being made by, for me, artists, a lot of it I'm really struggling to like. I mean, it feels like I'm going to Camden Market in the 90s or trying to buy a Magic Eye poster from Athena. There doesn't the actual quality of the artworks for me, and may, I'm sure I'm going to get shot down, are not great. They feel quite basic. Like there's a screen grab of a tweet, or there's a meme of like a rat with a top hat with a rainbow coming out of his bum climbing a tree. Lovely, but I don't understand why that's. I can't in my head. I can't put the value on that.
I think talking about the individual artists, first of all, I think that will evolve, and you know, different artists will emerge from this world that we're going to all think, oh my god, this is amazing, this is incredible. These are the ones that the art world really thinks is fantastic. But I think there's actually some real merit in the ones that are already producing this right now. You know, some of these artists, you know, are producing and creating work which is visually very different from the things that we've maybe experienced, you know, across the, you know, in galleries or in museums and all those sorts of places. And I think it's really good. It's challenging us. It's challenging us and making us look at things differently.
Yeah.
And some of the work is actually really interesting. You know, yes, some of it really isn't, but there are some really great stuff that's being produced. And I think the way that it's being produced and who's producing it is also really interesting. I mean, some of them are really young. I mean, they're like 18-year-old kids that are, well, I shouldn't say kids, should I? Really? I don't know. 18-year-olds who are
young
making
adults.
This work. Young adults, exactly, making this work. And they're responding to the world around them. They live in this space. They grew up in this space. They're making work that comes from this world. And then they're selling it, you know, on these platforms to other people who have also grown up and been born out of this world. So I think for them, it feels probably incredibly natural. It is just a way of existing. You know, the way I think it's, you know, if you think about how what Google did to libraries and, you know, information encyclopedia sources, it completely dematerialized that. You think about what, and everyone thought, you know, no, I don't think anyone would have fully imagined what Google and the power Google could have had. You know, Facebook completely dematerialized the way we socialize. You know, I think that cryptocurrency is dematerializing the way that currency operates. And I think that what this is doing is dematerializing the way that we all imagine and interact with art. And that is fascinating.
Question then, the hierarchy of the art world, which we all fight against, is that, you know, someone who's outside of art, self-taught, isn't seen as valuable as a commodity, as this is talking about a commercial art market, as someone who has trained at the Royal Academy, for example, or the Royal College of Art and Slade.
Yeah,
or,
and although we're all campaigning to change that, and it is changing.
Exactly. But there is like a quality hierarchy within the art world that really supports the system. Now, with these artists that are creating these nifty artworks, where is the quality at, and who decides what the quality is of that, the hierarchy of like where they come from, what their craft is, where they're, or is it literally anyone can do this? Anyone can get involved, which I love, that it feels like outsider artists self-taught. That feels like wonderful. But is that the case? Is there anybody in this world that is deemed like the cause or the Warhol of nifties?
I think not yet, but they're coming. I think certainly the Beeple result was just, you know, incredible. And I think hit records that no one expected it to reach. You know, it's now the third highest price paid for an artwork by a living artist. I mean, that is quite extraordinary. You know, he doesn't have the track record.
What were the other
one
two?
Number one is Koons. Number two is David Hockney. And then Koons again in number four. So in between those, you've now got Beeple. You know, Beeple doesn't have the narrative that kind of supports, you know, Koons and Hockney, and then further down that list, I think you've got, you know, you have Lucian Freud a little bit below that. And that's, you know, these are artists that we're all really familiar with that, you know, you'd expect to be reaching those prices, you know, but I don't think that necessarily we should be here to judge what people are willing to pay for these things. And at the same time, I think we should be very willing to open our minds completely to what this, you know, the artists that are producing work right now, the people that are buying the work, and what they are looking for is very interesting, because they're generating a whole new way of consuming and viewing and engaging with art. And they're funding, by buying this work, they're funding a whole new way of operating, I suppose. The art market can be completely transformed by this. I just don't think we fully understand what will emerge from the foundations that have been laid as a result of, you know, this kind of recent flurry of NFTs.
But that's scary, isn't it? Is that scary for us? Is that scary for artists? Is it scary for, like, visual arts, galleries, museums? Is that something that everyone's now slightly panicking about?
Yeah, of course it's scary. Any major change is going to be scary for people. It's going to challenge everyone's ideas of what exists right now. I mean, I think we've been talking about some of these issues for years in the art world. You know, how can we break down certain structures? How can we make it fairer? How can we change things in the way that, you know, the gatekeepers maybe are a bit more challenged than they are currently? Well, this kind of does that if you allow it to. The technology in itself kind of lays the foundation, the platform for that, because it's decentralized. But the technology itself is not going to create a revolution. It's not going to create a democratic approach to the art world that we want it to. People have to do that. So actually, you know, on the one hand, yes, there is probably an argument to say that you want to see some more curatorial, you know, opinion in some of this.
Yes,
you want to
see, I guess that's what I'm
maybe
saying.
A bit more of an edit.
Yes.
Is another way of putting it. And there are certain platforms that are doing that to some extent. They are inviting artists onto the platform. They are curating, in the loosest sense, what goes on their platform. And others, you know, aren't doing that at all. But what I think, there's a double-edged sword where that's concerned, because I think that's really exciting that you can revolutionize all these things, like, you know, complete democratization of the art world and much wider than that. But, you know, this, and what you're doing by doing that is you're challenging those sort of traditional gatekeepers of who says what's what and what isn't. And, you know, we all are part of that. We're all involved with the art world. And, you know, and it functions largely rather well, but it doesn't serve everyone within the ecosystem fairly. And I think that what this allows, you know, all participants to do is to participate in a more fair way. And that comes down to the gatekeepers is one aspect of it. You challenge that structure. But at the same time, you can make sure there's a fair distribution for artists and creators generally, and the people involved with that, you know, not just at the point of sale, but forever. So the contracts that are put into place to create an NFT, those contracts allow for royalties to be written into the contract at the very beginning. So every time that an artwork is sold, that the original creator gets a percentage. Wow. If that's written in. So every resale of an NFT, if it is written into the contract, and most of them choose to have this, obviously, they would get, and it seems to be 10% is roughly what people are choosing to go with. Every time it's resold, they will get 10% of that resale value. That's incredible.
Well, that's the opposite of art flipping, isn't it? Where the artist doesn't get anything from that sale. Whereas
no, but they do
does.
Now, because there's an artist resale right in
there
the
is.
UK. But it's a small amount, isn't it?
It's a small amount. It's an average of 4%. And it's capped at something like €12,500. And so, you know, this isn't capped. You know, if you an NFT 10% royalty isn't capped, it's automatic as well. I mean, we can all imagine how a painting gets sold or an artwork gets sold. I mean, how do you track all that and the ARR and how it's paid and how it's given back to the artist? And, you know, I think that what's really amazing about this is...
Isn't ARR to do with the lifetime copyright? So if it's like, I don't know what it is it 100 years or 70 years after someone dies, there's still a copyright?
70 years in the UK, but it varies 70. Around the world, yeah.
Yeah, so with this kind of, you know, NFT kind of 10%, would that be infinite, or is that also limited to a kind of copyright... Life.
Yes, exactly. Most people write it in. I mean, each contract could be different. That's the other key thing, you know, and that's where a lot of these standardized contracts that are being used at the moment might not be right for the more sophisticated art structures, or, you know, you're working with a gallery or with an artist and you're putting it out to a group of collectors. You might need that's where, you know, certainly what I'm working on at the moment with two or three collectives where the actual standard contracts don't quite work. The structures aren't quite right, because in one particular case, we're choosing to not only give a percentage to the original creator, but also to the original collaborators to help make that happen, because you need certain other skills to make that artwork come to life. It's not just the artist, but it's also the people who produce that work and edit that work. And then the other aspect of it, which we're doing, which is really interesting, is putting a percentage of all future sales to a public institution. So that's what I think is also really powerful, is that you can build into the original, you know, the foundation of an artwork. So let's say, I don't know, you know, we all, the three of us sit down and we decide that we want to create a collective and we get an artist involved and we make this fantastic piece of work, which is sold, you know, in a series, let's say, and there are three of them sold and they all go to individual collectors. But every time that gets sold, there's a royalty paid back to the original artist. There may be another percentage that goes to other collaborators that help make that happen. But let's say 10% would also always go to the Tate, for example. That's written into the contract.
Wow.
It's a smart contract.
Could it be a charity thing as well? Like,
it can be. And I think that's what's exciting. It has the power to have to transform philanthropy within the art world. And it's automated.
Yes, exactly.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast. And we're here today with Budweiser Beer. And we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
All of these ideas, like kind of blue sky thinking, if you like, all sound great, of course. But the thing is that confused me is that when an artist, say, like Beeple, you know, suddenly is worth all this money and you have never heard of him, it doesn't mean that he's not an artist. But certain people last week I was talking to were kind of like, but how do we know that's art? Is it art? And therefore, is it just money laundering? Because it's a way of like putting money into, you know, this kind of agreement or something, and it's not really art. Like, are people just being tricked if there's no regulation? It's a really complicated thing.
It's about
thinking.
It's about thinking outside the box. We're at this stage in history now where we're living in the future. We've all been locked down in the pandemic. Everything has become like museums have been closed. You haven't been able to go galleries, and suddenly it's like we're making this art online. We're living our lives online. So why is this not as important as what we're seeing in front of our eyes in every day? Because yeah. What we're seeing on the screen is as important. Suddenly you're on Zoom all the time, you're on FaceTime. That's real, but that isn't real in itself, you know?
But the reason like we've all started talking about it was largely because Christie's got involved, who are an organization that are incredibly traditional, you know, and sort of respected and have this kind of gravitas in a way, particularly in the secondary world, you know.
They're opinion formers.
Yeah, they are. And also it's kind of, it's got kind of credibility, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And they're meant to be transparent as an organization. So for them to get involved shocked a lot of people, I think, because like one of my friends was saying that, you know, the FBI has shut down certain websites or like, you know, if you think about Silk Road and the controversies around that, like,
Which is a black market trading, like dark web, isn't it?
Yeah, but there's all this kind of murkiness to it as well. So on one hand, you've got this wonderful, you know, progressive kind of free thinking and free to creativity and breaking down the doorkeepers.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's all mired in...
Isn't that the art world, Rob? Don't we exist in an art world where we have all the murky stuff, where it is all kind of insider trading, speculating, flipping, everything, getting this artist's prices up, but it's all just everyone bidding against each other.
Immense privilege, you know, benefiting the wealth of wealthy people.
You know, I think if you take a sort of more sort of generational forward-thinking attitude to this, yes, you can have these utopian ideas and you can think that, oh my goodness, wouldn't it be amazing if all this actually happened? And in reality, much of it won't happen. And what we're talking about today probably will be very different tomorrow. But what I think it does is it allows you to, if you can identify where the potential issues are, you can then work out how you kind of overcome them. And a lot of what you're talking about, you know, the kind of potential illegality around these things, those things are, that's what real life law enforcement and the justice system is there for. You know, just because it happens online doesn't necessarily mean that our governments and our justice system doesn't have, you know, kind of jurisdiction over those transactions. And that what's really interesting in the way that these contracts operate and the way that the blockchain operates is that it is actually transparent. We can all see what's happened. So if I go on and look at an NFT that sold yesterday, and let's say it's been put on the open marketplace again on the same platform and has been resold, you can see who has bought it. Yeah, all the transaction history is there and will always be there. So,
yeah, but can you trace who that person is, though, if it's under a pseudonym or a made-up name?
That's a big part of it. And I think that's what a lot of authorities are looking at. It's like looking at how do you get transparency into a world which is seemingly completely transparent and traceable, but at the same time, it's a series of numbers that doesn't mean anything to anyone. And that, I think, is definitely a challenge. And that's why Christie's, the way they did it was to ensure that, you know, if you're going to bid, you had to follow certain procedures in the way that you would any other bidder would have to. And you had to transact through, I think you had to use Coinbase and you had to use Ethereum and all these other, you know, conditions that were around the sale, I suppose, to mitigate as many of those risks as possible. I mean, and I think we need to be careful. Like, no, I don't think anyone could accuse Beeple of having done anything that's not, you know, completely above board, because I think that would be, you know, I don't think that we should assume that everyone that's involved with this world is has got some kind of ulterior motive.
No.
Inevitably, though, that is.
No, you're right. It's just like the whole world. It's like the real world, isn't it? It's the same thing in a way. And also, people like the art world in the past year has had to apply these new know your client regulations for the whole of Europe, even including the UK, even after we left Brexit, to make sure that any payment over €8,000, you know who your client client is. You have their passport, you have their address, you have their utility bills. And Christie's obviously follow that regulation for all of their sales, regardless of whether it's Bitcoin or whatever it is.
I was going to say, what's fascinating is actually the people that did bid on that. There were 22 million people watching that sale on Christie's website yesterday. 91% of the people that bid were completely new to Christie's. 91%. So, you know, we're talking about this in, you know, the framework that we already understand. But this is a whole, you know, the creators, the collectors, the world that's watching it, it's all entirely new. So, you know, I think that what's fascinating is that it's been born out of this, you know, crypto world. It's not something that, you know, we can almost retrospectively apply our own ideas and structures around, because it is very new and the people that are operating within it operate very differently. And so, like, if for example the underbidder yesterday was he missed out, you know, by a technical quirk within the Christie's system, which he went to Twitter to talk about, and then Christie's responded, wrote to him, and then he put it up online. And actually what it did was highlight the fact that the technology that's being used by Christie's, he challenged it. He was like, actually, I think we should be using blockchain, because then it's all completely clear, it's all completely transparent, and, you know, these problems wouldn't happen. And I think so, you know, it's interesting, these new people coming into the market are making us maybe think about not just the art, but the way that we transact with it.
Wow.
Yeah, they're sort of reforming the existing structures. Wow. Yeah.
Exactly. Was Christie's like listening to that, or were they like, no, we like what we've got?
They sort of, I think they slightly brushed it off. But, you know, I don't think, and he was very gracious. He was like, I accept that this is how you operate, Christie's. It's fine. I'll find the next big artist and I'll move on. But I think tip for me, yeah, I think this is how you could, you know, change your systems. It was very gracious. He did it very well. But actually, it raised some really interesting points.
And one really quick question before Russell moves on. Is the value sort of a risk, as in, like, I know it would be anyway, if you bought a Warhol at a certain price, it might drop another year later or something. So is there a risk, a bit like you were talking about these huge jumps, which are unusual with cryptocurrencies, the way they can jump 10% or 50%, is there a risk that person who invested all that money, or sorry, all that cryptocurrency, could have a huge loss from this purchase?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think volatility is almost inherent to the system at the moment. I think I think that no one should go into this without their eyes wide open. It's certainly not for the faint-hearted. I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. It's going to take time for it to mature, and it will take time for, you know, kind of other artists, maybe more established artists or new artists that have not yet been discovered, to come onto the scene, to allow this particular form of art to kind of mature and allow then the market to sort of stabilize a little bit more.
Mm.
You know, I don't know who can possibly say whether people's thing is going to be worth 69 million tomorrow, having paid that yesterday. I mean, as we said earlier, it's not like, you know, Hockney or Lucian Freud, where you can just point to a whole other load of data points and say, these are other paintings or whatever, or sculptures that are sold.
But there are artists like Damien Hirst who are now accepting cryptocurrency, apparently.
Absolutely. Yes.
So there's leading artists, you know, of the day, who are now going to be getting involved with cryptocurrencies when they weren't before. So that's also interesting.
I'd love to see Hockney with his iPad drawings starting to charge cryptocurrency for them.
I love it. I would love it if Hockney starts at
incredible
Bitcoin.
Hockney Bitcoin.
But, you know, the guy who bought Beeple, he's come out saying he thinks it's not, you know, 69 million was a bargain. He thinks it's worth 1 billion. And he's now put it into this thing. He's fractionalizing the artwork, essentially, because he's been bought by this thing called, you know, Metapurse, which is a sort of a fund for NFTs. And you can buy a token for that fund, which allows you to... it might not even be a guy.
His name is Meta Kovan, as he's come out. That's his pseudonym. Yeah. And he's described on Instagram as a crypto native, and he holds the largest known NFT collection in the world right now.
Exactly.
So he sounds like someone who's got a lot of money. But who sets the prices on them? That's the thing, is that I've been going through the Nifty websites, and I've been going through Makespace, and they're all different prices. Who is it, the artist says, my work is worth this, or is it the people who run the websites selling these artworks, that's what you should market your work at?
It's largely the artists. They are choosing what they put into their... When you mint a work, when you mint as an artist, when you mint your NFT, you choose the terms that you put into that contract, and you can set the price, and you can change the price as well. It's one of the things you can continue to change, because the key thing about NFTs is once you've created it, it's there forever. You cannot change it, which is obviously exciting, but it's also a challenge, because you know you got to make sure you get it right the first time. And so you can set the price, but you can also change the price throughout. You can either have it available immediately for a particular price, or you can set it as an auction, and that will allow some flexibility in the way you control, you know, the way you market your work. But there's also in the background, there are galleries and there are curators who are involved with this world already and are to some extent guiding artists in the way that they want to market their work, what they're going to put out there, which platforms they're going to go on to, and how they, you know, what price they attach to it. So I think that will definitely change as well over time as more people get involved.
And how hard is it to apply to be an artist? Because one of my other artist friends was like, I don't like the fact that you have to apply to these websites to sort of register yourself as an artist. Like, what a ludicrous
same
kind
as a
of
collector,
idea.
I guess, isn't it? You have to register to be a collector to buy the work. I guess this is all trying to, you know, track it down, be part of this blockchain, this DNA chain that we're all in.
Yeah, but what if you don't get approved as an artist though?
Well, I think, Rob, that's really right. You know, it's like, you know, actually, why are these platforms emerging? They're emerging because the world is so complex. Because it's really, you know, a lot of it's just a string of numbers, and you've got to get your head around, you know, wallets and cryptocurrency and where, you know, all these contracts and everything else, and none of it is in plain English, which goes against entirely the way, you know, kind of the movement of the legal world generally over the last 20 years. So, you know, how is that being resolved? Well, all these platforms are being, you know, launched, you know, whether it's Foundation or Nifty Gateway or any of the others, to make it understandable and easy to mint your work, to put your work up there and make it available for sale and easy for people to acquire it. But of course, though, what that's doing is while on one hand we're saying it's breaking down all the old structures and challenging the way that we operate, but at the same time, you're putting in place all those things. And who are behind all these platforms? You know, there are some that have got curators and boards and everything else involved, which is great. And then there are others which we don't quite know who's making those decisions.
It feels like Bridgerton. You know, at the end when you're like, who's been writing all these gossip columns? And it's like, it's her. You didn't know it's me.
But also that's a good point, though, about male and female and trans and LGBTQ and non-binary. And like, who are these people? Like, is it because some people are saying that it's kind of like computer gaming, which historically was seen as a kind of male domain almost. Like, so is that a negative thing if these structures are being built just by men? Do you know what I mean? Like, maybe they're not, though. Maybe they're being built by women. I don't know. But like, how is that equal? Do you know what I mean?
I think they're definitely, your point about gamification of all this stuff is definitely, you know, there's an element of that involved with this, I'm absolutely sure. And, you know, maybe it is more male dominated at the moment. I've seen some criticism online that's mainly, you know, kind of there could be a race element to this as well.
Exactly.
Maybe that is the case, but I think there's actually an opportunity where that is concerned, and not just but for marginalized groups generally. You know, I think there's a real potential for, you know, I'm working with one particular collective at the moment, which is working with LGBT artists who are not, they're in countries where it is illegal to be homosexual. They're producing their work. They see this as a huge opportunity to be able to make their work available to a massive audience, and to be able to collect other artists as well and hold them in a digital collection, essentially, without running the risk of being criminalized in their own countries. So I think that has a real potential and a way to really kind of lift up some marginalized groups. And I hope that will be some of the opportunity that is born out of this system.
I guess the only thing, though, is whether, like, an artist like Damien Hirst can accept cryptocurrency because he can already put food on his table on a really basic level. He owns his house, I expect. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Like, but if you're an artist that's, like, paying rent and can't even afford to pay your rent, how do you then get involved with, you know what I mean? Like, that's the only the thing I find confusing at the moment.
You just pay a fee to make the work, do you? You don't have to pay a fee to market it. You just...
No, but, well, you do, to some extent. You have to pay a fee to mint it, and that could be, you know, and it could be $100 to mint that.
And you have to have a computer and all that stuff. Exactly.
You've got to have all the equipment, as Rob said earlier, and you've got to be able, you pay to mint your work, all the gas fees and everything else, and that could be, you know, a sizable amount of someone's weekly, monthly income.
Per,
who knows?
Per work, the additions.
Yeah, and plus you were talking about other people collaborating with you, maybe to do the technology side of it. If it's a moving video or something, you might need someone to help you realise that. So
yes, exactly.
I just think it's quite, it does seem at the moment to me that you have to be quite well off in order to even be involved with this.
I think there probably is an element of that, but I think that Yes, there probably is certainly an element of that, and maybe that will be addressed as they change the technology to allow some of these transaction fees to be reduced, because I think that will allow more people to enter the market. But it doesn't. Mm. You're right. There's technology issues which will limit certain people. But if you can, yeah, I mean, you really want to democratize this. You need to make sure that everyone has access to the technology that's required to do it. And I think that there's a
exactly.
You know, which was the founding principle of the internet as well, of course.
Well, exactly. Tim Berners-Lee, that's where it's kind of to open it up. And I think, you know, to your point about the money that the artists are going to receive, can they afford to receive cryptocurrency or run the risk that what they receive one day might be, you know, by the time they've come to change it into their bank accounts, it's suddenly halved in value. I mean, you know, that is a risk. And it's interesting to note that Christie's, they accepted cryptocurrency yesterday as a bidding currency, but their buyers, their commission was payable within fiat currency. They didn't accept cryptocurrency for their fees, their commission. So I think that's interesting. You know, I think.
So Christie's themselves weren't accepting it.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think, you know, maybe that will change over time. Maybe you'll be able to choose whether it is you receive your payment in cryptocurrency or within dollars or pounds or whatever it might be. That could possibly change. I think that's a technological thing rather than necessarily a barrier.
Yes. Okay.
Mm. Yeah. All right. So this marriage between art and tech, how does this affect you, Simon? Because you are an art advisor, curator to private and corporate collections globally, art collections, and you're saying there you've got your collectors like asking you all the questions: how do I buy, how do I get involved, what should I be doing? How is this changing the landscape for you as someone, as an art advisor predominantly, advising people to collect art and for institutions and private and personal collections?
I think the biggest thing is helping people understand it initially, and helping people understand what the challenges are and what the opportunities are, and making sure the clients I'm speaking to at the moment, I'm doing a whole series of these Zoom talks for different collectors all around the world, and what they want to understand is how do they go about doing it, how are they best placed to respond to the market when they find something they really like. Because it may not be something they're not going to just jump in and buy the first thing that, you know, springs up on their screen. They're going to take time. They're going to learn about the market. They're going to explore which artists are producing work and, you know, ones that they want to, you know, either add to their existing collection or build a whole new other collection alongside it, whether that is a, you know, a nifty collection. And I think that's really fascinating. So helping them kind of first understand that what the technology looks like, what it allows them to do, then put in all the structures in place to help them, you know, be well placed to acquire the work when they find the thing they're looking for. But then really understanding what they want to achieve with their collection. Is it a standalone collection of digital art, or is it something which complements what they already have? And then there's all the, you know, the questions around display. You know, I think people have to really get their heads around the idea that, you know, this isn't necessarily a tangible piece of work you're going to suddenly, you know, kind of be able to hang on your wall. It is like digital art of, you know, that we've all experienced: sound art, video art, performance. You know, the concepts of as a collector of how you interact with that work and how you add it to a collection. Of course, there's similar questions, and you just got to understand, you know, get your head around what you expect from, you know, this piece of work, and then how you want to have that fit within the landscape of your collection. An interesting point about nifties as well is that the artwork doesn't actually sit within the nifty. So within the NFT, I should say. It doesn't. The NFT is the token that points to the artwork. So your token, your NFT, sits on the blockchain as a series, as a record.
Yeah.
Of your ownership.
Your ID.
The actual artwork, let's say it's a high-res JPEG of a particular thing, that sits somewhere else, largely, usually. It sits on a separate server somewhere else.
Why? Why are they not together?
Because the blockchain is largely like a interlinked database, is maybe the best way to think of it. And it's a record, like the title deeds to your house. They sit somewhere else and they point to your house. So you have a title deed to your house that points to your house and says, Russell Tovey owns this house. Rob owns this house. And it is here, it's located here, and it looks like this. And it shows the transactions.
Yeah, and the same with like leasehold or freehold.
Exactly.
And like I had a guy who's an art advisor, Robert Norton, who approached us about making such kind of blockchain certificates for, say, counter editions prints. Yeah. And that if you sell 300, edition of 300, that each of those would also come with a blockchain certificate which points to the physical print.
Exactly.
He's been talking to us for years, but we've never taken
it. It's much like that. So, you know, your physical print exists somewhere else, but it points to that. So, but I think the difference in the real world, if you've got a blockchain certificate that points to a real limited edition print that you have hanging on your wall, you know where it is. You've got this, you know, this other digital art sitting elsewhere on maybe a third party server or maybe on the server of the platform that you bought it through. And so you're relying on the robustness of that server to be able to access forever your artwork. So I think there are some issues to be resolved there. I think we've got to look at how do you actually hold it? Are you entitled to hold it offline? Are you entitled to hold it on a hard drive? You know, and also there's a technological issues to it. It's like, you know, if people bought video art in the early 1980s and they bought it on a Betamax, do they have a right to then convert it to VHS or DVD or whatever else? So, you know, I think those things...
And that's been a huge... That's been a huge discussion for years now, for about the last 10 years since I've been working in the art world. Loads of collectors who collect video art, that's one of their major concerns, is about the transition between different media. It's a really important thing, VHS to, you know...
Absolutely. And, you know, you need...
Hard drive die.
And that's what some of these contracts don't do. A lot of these contracts are standardized. So you need to kind of, you know, really understand what you're buying and what rights you have as the buyer of that work. You know, can you recreate it in a different format as the technology changes? Are you allowed to have, you know, a kind of the way you store it? Does that need to be, you know, held in a particular way? And I think that the other issue is with the platforms. At the moment, some of the NFTs that you buy, you could only, they are minted on a particular platform, they're hosted on a particular platform and acquired through a particular platform, and then you are only able to resell them through that platform. And I think that is a limitation which needs to be overcome. Because imagine if you bought an artwork from a painting from a one gallery. And for, you know, for all of these wonderful utopian ideas we're talking about, the only way you can ever resell it is back through that gallery to the clients of that gallery. So, you suddenly are very, you know, narrow in what you can do. So I think that needs to be resolved as well. They need to be much more transferable across different platforms. And I think you also have to be able to the contract to understand that if that platform, let's say it's Nifty Gateway or Foundation, for whatever reason doesn't exist in 5 years' time, you know, what happens then? You know, do you, you know, yes, you've got your blockchain NFT, but your artwork might have been hosted by them. You know, where is it now, kind of thing?
Yeah. So as a Nifty Nostradamus, which we're going to coin you as, mint you as, actually, if you were seeing this coming, have you been collecting yourself, and are you one of these pseudonyms that now are sitting on millions and millions and millions of Nifty artworks?
I do own a series of NFTs, yes.
When did you start collecting them?
Relatively recently, within the last year. But I've been interested in digital art for a long time, you know, because I think the potential that it offers is really interesting. You know, I surround myself by paintings and sculpture, but I also love the idea of what technology can bring to the art world. You know, as a curator, I've hosted many exhibitions which incorporate video art and performance and all those things. And to me, it just feels like, you know, why would you want to close your mind or your collection to those things? So, yeah, I do collect NFTs. And what's interesting is NFTs aren't just art as well. They're tokenization of digital assets, crypto assets. So, you know, there are lots of things that you can apply an NFT to. But yes, I do have a small and growing collection of NFTs.
And your crew that you work with then, are you advising everyone to get onto this and learn and educate and buy?
Yes, with caution. Right. I think you've got to apply the same principles you'd apply to collecting any piece of art. You've first of all got to understand what it is that you're looking at. Yeah. And you've got to understand what the artist is about and enjoy and look at the work and really enjoy it. Of course, you apply all the principles you ordinarily would. And then, yes, you know, don't get carried away. Don't be silly. Make sure you can only, you know, buy what you can afford, obviously. Yeah. And you know, have some fun with it. I would encourage anyone to do
that. Well, I like what you're saying about working out what the artist is about, though, because, you know, a lot of these are graphic designers. Nothing against graphic designers, but they're not fine artists. They're people that know how to work, you know, images, Photoshop or whatever it is on the computer. They're savvy to that. And now they have this clout. They have this, like weight to their to their practice now through this work. How do you sift through and find the guys who are doing serious work and aren't just kind of jumping on this now?
I think that's interesting. What we're talking about, I suppose, in that context, are the artists that we're all looking at on screen at the moment, and the ones that are grabbing the headlines, the ones like, you know, I don't know, Beeple and CryptoPunks and all those sort of artists that are getting the, you know...
Who else is there? Give us some more names.
Well, there are a bunch of them. So you've got, you know, did you read about the Banksy that was burnt? There was a group of people that bought a Banksy print and then they burnt it in a car park and then filmed that and then sold it as an NFT. And actually they bought the print for like $95,000 or something and then sold it for astronomical sums. And so they made a massive profit. They actually increased the value of that original artwork, which is, well, fascinating in itself.
Yeah.
And they call themselves Pest Supply rather than Pest Control, which is the authentication body for Banksy, of course. And then there's Pack, which I think is really interesting. Pack is doing some, you know, there's some work that I quite like. A lot of his work is it's unique rather than multiples, and that's quite interesting. CryptoPunks is another one that everyone seems to be talking about. You know, I'm not necessarily speaking to the merits of these individual artists, because I think that, you know, what will emerge is going to be more interesting, but what they're doing is laying the foundations. And I'm curating an exhibition in London and in New York, which is going to be very interesting, and exploring a lot of the artists that are doing things in this area has been fascinating. So it's not just the ones that we're talking about, oh, wow, getting all the headlines and we're looking on screen, but there are a lot of young artists who are producing work where you're born entirely out of this world, you know, where their work is, you know, generative artwork in its, you know, essence. You know, it's produced through, you know, technology, you know, whether it's a painting produced, you know, digitally, or whether it is work that is produced, yeah, offline, but entirely with the idea that it will end up being only a digital manifestation of that work. So there are lots of artists doing interesting things. So, you know, I suppose there's an artist in the UK at the moment who's working exclusively producing paintings through the computer, through her computer. And then there's another guy who's producing paintings that he is specifically trying to convert, you know, making them to convert them into digital manifestations. So I think that is fascinating. They've all got a narrative. They've gone through, you know, kind of art school rigor. They've applied all of their life experience living through.
Well, that I can get onto. That I can understand in my head. It just feels like anybody can suddenly jump on and they're making something. Like I can do something, take a photograph of a can of Coke and then put it online. It feels like that then frustrates me, and I guess that frustrates a lot of people because it just feels like they know a bit more and then they've got in on it.
You're right. At the moment, there is a bit of a gold rush,
right?
I think, and people are piling in, yes, and people are trying to be a bit opportunistic, and, you know, we can all be a bit cynical about that. And I think that's why I say with anyone, go in with caution, take your time and make sure that this is not going to go away overnight.
Mm.
You know, maybe we are seeing a bubble. I mean, possibly we are. It's got all the hallmarks of that. But, you know, that might just see a correction. But I don't think the fundamentals are going to suddenly disappear.
No.
And, you know, talking about, you know, which other artists as well, I'm working with a collective called Golden Tail at the moment, which is just such a great name for a collective anyway. And that's a filmmaker, a photographer and a sound artist who have all got incredible CVs, done amazing stuff, exhibited at the Tate individually and all these other places. But they're producing this fantastic piece of work they've been working on for a period of time, always anticipating that it will be a digital work. And now this has just created the market for them. And I think that's exciting.
Really,
you know, that's exciting. Where I think it will happen.
I think you're right, Simon. And I think even if this was a bubble, say, the lessons that can be learned about forward thinking and kind of changing your approach and the openness that you can have to making digital work. And if you look at people like Data Editions, you know, DAATA, yeah, which was set up by David Grin,
yeah,
and I think backed by Anita Zabadovich, actually. But if you look at the list of artists on their website, it's all digital artworks, and that they're editions of, you know, different amounts, maybe 100, maybe 5, maybe 10, I'm not sure of the numbers. But the artists, they've got like Judy Chicago, Tracy Emin, you know, there's a huge list of artists on there, loads of amazing women artists, you know, younger artists like Ed Fornieles, like all kinds of people are on there. And I think that in itself, that's been going on for at least, I don't know, 8 years now. True. So that in itself shows contemporary artists are interested in digital art and in the digital realm. And maybe it just wasn't.
Well, it's a generational thing, isn't it? Post-internet art. And,
Yeah.
Well, like you touched on Hockney's iPad drawings earlier. I mean, how incredible that they're fantastic and they're very clearly Hockney's work. The fact that he produced them on an iPad, I mean, who cares in many ways? I mean, it's like, you know, it's just a different medium. And I think that we're going to see many more artists that we all know that are sort of household names producing very interesting work, not just because they, you know, suddenly want to make a load of money. That's not the motivation, but it's the potential that this offers. You know, maybe it is just being attracted to the different way of being able to share in the kind of upside of these things, not just for themselves, but for the other people and things that causes they believe in, you know, for the way that it could allow them to create a very different kind of work. I think that is fascinating in itself. But I think, you know, to me, it feels almost like as revolutionary as the kind of the you know, the Gutenberg press, or, you know, the kind of, you know, the way that that changed everything.
What's the Gutenberg press?
The printing press. So the way that, you know, the invention of the printing press. So the way that information could be disseminated on a massive scale. So, you know, beforehand it was relying on word of mouth, and then suddenly the Gutenberg press, or the printing press, you know, automated printing of books and text, allowed, you know, information to spread very rapidly across jurisdictions in a way that it never had been able to be done before. And what that also gave rise to, interestingly, was the rise of different languages. So you could have printing in different languages across Europe. And it broke down the systems of the old school elite, where information was and education was controlled by the elite and often disseminated in Latin. And the, you know, the majority of people couldn't understand Latin. So you had the the printing press allowed national languages to emerge, and then text to be produced in national languages. So for more people to access information, literacy then emerged, and the idea of authorship became more and more important. And then you have the copyright law emerge from that. And I think there's something interesting. You know, this could be a something similar happening right now, where you're seeing this massive democratization of the art world, and in a way that it's allowing many different people to get involved, but also produce very different kinds of work. And it references forever the author, the originator of that work.
And it is interesting, this idea of validity to do with value. So the idea that suddenly digital art is being taken seriously just because something sold for plus 60 million. Yep. Do you know what I mean? And if you think of these younger artists in the past 5 years, even if you think of someone like Amalia Ullman, who I know was referencing the internet, and, you know, all that kind of younger generation, who a lot of the works might be works filmed on Instagram or you know, on WhatsApp or communicating through a website, like, and now maybe because suddenly they're seen that it has like a financial worth, there's been this value put on that, therefore everyone
art history
accept it,
isn't it,
which is in a way just the way humans are. I guess people need to feel things have value.
Yes, and but isn't it great for those artists that it gives them that opportunity to monetize or to get some kind of, you know, return for all their endeavor. I mean, I think
they're probably going, finally,
exactly.
This is going to be taken
seriously. But also, maybe it will give permission to a new generation to be able to have space and have exhibitions of this kind of work, which maybe before wouldn't have come.
Absolutely.
And that's the positive aspect, which I'm into.
Yeah, same.
I'm into the creativity of it all. I just want to make sure there isn't dark crap happening in the background, because the idea that you'd be like linked to like human trafficking or something.
Yeah, that
you
would
know
be
what I mean?
Really
like
bad.
It's all just dark, allegedly, of course.
Yes.
But I think it's really fascinating, you know, the idea that someone, you know, I don't know, someone who lives in the middle of a city in a relatively small apartment, you know, they could have theoretically a collection of, you know, 500 or 1,000 artworks.
Yeah, it's amazing.
That just sits on, you know, on their computer, and they can kind of display if they want
projector
to on a monitor in the way. Yeah, one thing each day,
that's
each hour. Who knows? Yeah. But you know, I think the potential is huge, and and so long as people allow themselves to, you know, challenge the downsides and work out solutions to that, then the upside is going to be great. And I think that, you know, it's interesting to look at how some artists that we all know today, maybe they would disagree. I know some of the, you know, maybe like Nicholas Party or Louis Hollowell or some of those artists that produce work, which I would say it kind of has
even Photoshop like energy to it. Yeah,
it does. Yeah. It does, and you know, and it's
or even Jamie and Giuliano
Villani.
Exactly. You know, and their work is. Yeah, they probably would disagree, and they would say it doesn't necessarily. It's not referencing that or anything else, but you know, maybe there is a connection there. Mm. Maybe there is. Maybe that was the earlier form of
well, yeah, that's their formative years, isn't it? That's the younger generation. That's their
digital aesthetic that's come from that era. Yeah,
exactly. Well, we're living in the future, and it feels like this is art history. But that story about Banksy burning the Banksy print and then putting it online really reminds me. Like, as an art historical reference for that came to mind is when Robert Rauschenberg got a drawing by Willem de Kooning, and he completely erased it and then put it in a frame, and then made that part of his practice, and he sort of appropriated that. And it's like changing art history and then moving that dialogue on feels like rebellious but needed.
I agree, but I think also it has a real potential for collaboration as well. You know, you think about how like Jasper Johns and Beckett kind of collaborated on various projects, and that you know, when I was doing I curated that program, the Pin Drop program at the Royal Academy for 5 years, and we had this amazing performance by Lisa Tuan, who read Beckett, and she read the extracts that have been selected and written in response to Jasper Johns' paintings. Those, you know, that was an amazing collaboration, and I think that digital art has the potential to really bring people together and to produce whole new bodies of work, which I think would be fascinating. And you know, we've seen it before and we'll see it again, I'm sure.
And also, if you think of something like Michael Craig Martin's like Oak Tree with the Glass of Water, I do feel like digital realm somehow would have a very strong connection to conceptual art. I'm sure there's really genius, you know, ways of
sound
coming
art
up with
sound art works completely. Incredibly well.
It really does. The artist I'm working with at the moment in this collective is just, it's mind-boggling. It's capturing urban sounds and the decay of abandoned buildings is just, it's fascinating. And merging that with photography is just, it's really quite beautiful and very powerful.
I think everyone needs to... Yeah. Everyone needs to follow you, Simon. They're all going. I think you're going to have thousands of people sliding into your DMs, going, "What should I buy? What do I do?"
You've already got thousands. I noticed loads of organisations like writing in your comments saying, "Please give us a talk." Please.
I think you're going to clean up.
What is your Instagram, Simon?
It is Simon. Annoyingly, Simon _ Oldfield. You know, so that's my Instagram.
That's in the blockchain now. You've minted that.
I've just minted it. Yeah. It is interesting, you know. Actually, you know, talking about I don't know how technical to get on this, but it is actually. I'm just going to say it. You can cut it out if you like. The way that why domain names exist is because it resolved a problem that was existing at the early stage of the internet, where like Microsoft.com was a series of numbers like 202.111. Blah blah blah, whatever. So they created the domain name system to kind of make it easier for everyone to access the internet, right? So you put into put in www.microsoft.com and it goes to the Microsoft website rather than 202.123, blah, blah, blah. What we've got at the moment is a whole range of Ethereum numbers or blockchain numbers or whatever however your wallet exists, you have a whole load of numbers, string of numbers, 42 of them, that is your unique set of numbers that allows you to buy an NFT, for example. You know, that's really confusing. You've got to get every single digit right. You get it wrong and you lose your money, you lose your NFT. It can get transferred to the wrong wallet and there's no recourse. That's it. So you've got to make sure it's really right. There's a whole load of other, I suppose, infrastructure that needs to be in place for the way that we are all going to interact and operate in the future. And so one of the things which I've been doing over the last 3 months is working with some fairly big organizations and galleries, helping them understand what they need to do to ensure that they are well placed to be ready for what's coming. Because there's a case that happened years ago where someone just registered like marksandspencer.com, waitrose.com, and all these things. And of course, they came into conflict with the trademarks, but they also had problems because they had to wrestle these domain names back from this you know, guy who'd registered all these domain names. So that's just one example of, you need to have this sort of like a whole catalogue of things in place to make sure that you are well placed to operate within this world. And all I can say is there are some really big organisations, really well-known galleries, that if I just I just by looking before doing my research for this, I was slightly horrified at how it's just out there for someone else to take. So if any big institution is listening or gallery, you know, do give me a call and I'll let you know whether you're one of the people that should be doing things differently. Some of them are really ahead of the game. Some of the galleries are doing all of it.
Like who? Like
some
who?
Of them. I can't say that because otherwise I'm giving disadvantage to people. I feel like if I say their names either way, you're giving advantage to one and you're kind of triggering the others to go and then go and buy up all, you know, bad actors to go and buy up all these other things.
Right.
It's fascinating, and it feels like, you know, equally, I don't know, yeah. I just don't feel I can say any more, because if I did, I would just get,
you get shot.
Trouble.
We're talking about curating, right? So we're just going to touch on this quickly. You have curated this incredible anthology of short stories that me and you collaborated on. I met you at the start of Pin Drop, and it's kind of like performance art in a way.
Explain what Pin Drop is, though, because people don't know what Pin Drop is.
So Pin Drop is an organisation that Simon set up where it's basically reading stories to adults, like you was read to as a kid, and everybody as a kid loved it, like being read to by your teachers, yeah, by family members, by anyone. As an adult, we don't do that. And that's the rise of audiobooks, that's the rise of podcasts, because people are looking for that voice, that soothing thing in your head you haven't got to think about. Well, Pin Drop was developed because adults love to be read to, and they weren't. And what Simon did was, he was a conduit to bring a performer and a writer together and then bring an audience in, and these performances would happen, these happenings. And I've
been to a few of them with you, because Russell's been an actor, obviously, who's read some of these short stories. So I went to Burberry in central London about 5 years ago, and Russell read a story to all of us, and it was extraordinary.
The Turner Contemporary.
And then we travelled to Turner Contemporary in Margate, but we also went down to Somerset to
Houser and Worth
in Bruton. Yeah. And we had an amazing weekend where we all stayed there, and it was a real adventure. And you even sold the book, and it was really funny because you've done two books so far, and the first one that came out had Eddie Peake's artwork.
Well, it's the same book, but it's a paperback and a hardback.
Paperback and hardback. But the first edition of it, Russell actually signed, and he hadn't even written anything in the book. And it was really funny because all these people were walking up to him after his reading, getting him to sign the book. And I was like, Russ, you're not even in the book. But you then corrected it for the second version of it, the paperback, because Russell actually wrote a story.
He did. He wrote an amazing story called The Kiss. And I love it. It's a really amazing story, and illustrated by Tracy Emin, the lovely Tracy Emin. So it's a great story. And fiction, right? Is that right? Is it your it was your debut, wasn't it, Russ? I think nothing else.
It was
your debut fiction publication.
Yes.
Debut, yeah. Right? Yeah. It is it's a great story.
Now you can't stop him.
Can't stop me.
No.
It's all your fault.
He's a great writer.
But you curated this book. You paired up artists who were then doing illustration with every writer. So throughout this book, you have these incredible, as Stephen Fry calls, a dazzling anthology called, and the book's called A Short Affair. And you paired up contemporary artists like Tracy Emin, Mary Ramsden, Eddie Peake, Fanny Perali. They all made unique artworks that went with the stories.
Exactly. So Pin Drop was started, as you say, to really to bring back the idea of storytelling, to really get to sit down and to really listen to a story and to engage with it. And for me, it was all about the union of art and literature. So from 2014, I've curated the Pin Drop program at the Royal Academy, which is about bringing very well-known authors and actors to the stage who will read a short story in response to the main exhibition program. And we've had amazing people perform, you know, Stephen Fry, you mentioned, and a whole host of other great writers and actors, including you, of course.
Oh, my God, we went to the one with you with Gwendolyn.
Gwendolyn
did the
exactly.
Royal Academy.
Gwendolyn
I came to that as well. I forgot about that one.
Yeah, she's
and Elizabeth Day was there from
she?
How to Fail as well.
And yes, and so the book was born out of that. And the idea was that we would find all these great writers, some that we discovered through the Pin Drop program and the prize that we operate, and then other best-selling writers like, I don't know, Will Self and Ben Ockrey and all these other great writers. And those artists were then, so writers were paired with artists from the Royal Academy, and they produced artworks in response to those stories. And yes, and the product is A Short Affair. And then the hardback is just this with this stunning Eddie Peake cover, which I adore. And then there's the paperback with this very amazing red and blue cover, which I think is just brilliant. It was hand-painted. Do you know that that cover was hand-painted by this genius at the publishing house at Simon & Schuster? It's so great.
Wow.
And that's got Russell's story in it with Tracy Emin's illustration. So yeah, that's Pin Drop.
Yeah, and we'll list that as well on our Instagram so people can follow that and buy that as well, because it's really worth getting. And you've got a series of podcasts as well, I saw, like recordings of some of these events.
We do.
Talks. And is Elizabeth Day involved with it?
She is, yeah. So I co-founded it with Elizabeth Day, who is...
That's what I thought, yeah, because I love her as well.
Exactly, and Elizabeth is also in the book, and she... And actually, going back to sort of some of the way that I've operated in the past and the shows I've curated, she was the first writer in residence that we had. So when we worked with, back in 2012, we moved our gallery from Covent Garden and moved it to Mayfair, where we were working in collaboration with Grosvenor Estate. And we were given this incredible building, which is now matches fashion opposite the Connaught on Carlos Place. And it's like...
It's all transformed. I mean, completely transformed. Always follows art.
It always does. I mean, we worked so hard. My poor mum, she was there at the front, you know, for like 2 weeks scrubbing away and lifting up all this like old carpet tiles. And then she was so excited because she discovered these old tiled little mosaic patterns in the entrance in Carlos Place. And she was like, she spent hours and hours there until 2 a.m. one night, just taking off this old cement that had been poured over the top of them. So we unveiled all that, worked really hard and put on these great exhibitions and, you know, had showed some great people and co-curated with different people. And Elizabeth was one of the writers in residence there. And that was when we decided that Pin Drop would be, you know, something that we wanted to turn into something more substantial. But that gave us the opportunity, that space at 6,000 square feet and across, I think it was 5 or 6 floors. And we had a whole room dedicated to film art. So we just had a rotation of different films 1 week at a time, different artists coming in. We had a whole floor for sound art. We had a whole floor for moving kinetic sculpture. And it's just like incredible to be able to give these opportunities to these artists and the platform. And then had on the first floor, we had this, you know, what was the ballroom of this incredible building. We had, that was where we had our sort of traditional either solo or curated exhibitions, group shows. And you know, we showed some great people in there, and you know, even people like Judy Blame, who didn't necessarily show very much usually, yeah, but had produced fantastic artwork. And that was in a show called Screw Your Courage, The Sticking Place, which I co-curated, in fact, with Princess Julia. And that was the kind of this amazing show that just explored, you know, kind of queer subculture and what that really meant. And that fed into a whole host of other shows that then, you know, were seen across different institutions looking at, you know, queer subculture. So yeah, it's a I don't know how I got on the tangent about my show.
Your successes, your achievements. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, exactly.
Well, you can, everyone listening, you can visit simonoldfield.com and you'll be able to see the whole archive there of lots of different things that Simon has done. She's also beautifully designed.
Did you see the beautiful website? Show?
It's so nice having you on the show. I'm so happy we did this. It's so good we're not, you know, because the show is also about friendship and it's nice that it's all.
Yeah, we go ways together. Back. So saying that, Simon, as we ask every guest, two very personal questions. The first one is, if you could do an art heist, you could steal any work of art in the world for yourself, what would it be and why?
Oh my goodness, that is such a challenge. You know what, I didn't even prepare for that. I was so worried about thinking about cryptocurrency and NFTs. I didn't think about the artwork I would want to steal the most from the world. I'm going to have to come back to you on that. Just give me a moment. And what's the other question?
Okay.
Ask me what's the second question?
The other question we ask every guest is, what is your favourite colour?
My favourite colour is definitely...
What is your favourite colour?
Yeah, my favourite colour is definitely Yves Klein blue. I adore it. It's just so rich and deep and gorgeous. I love it. It's like I have it at the end
Lose yourself in that colour.
I could lose myself in that colour. And I have a really beautiful... a really beautiful painting at the end of my bed, which I look at every morning, which is... Yves Klein blue, and it's adorable. It reminds me of happiness and childhood and love and hope and everything else. I just adore it. I think it's great, and it works so well with so many other colors, and that to me is, you know, really wonderful. My favorite artwork that I would want to live with forever, I think I might even reach way back. I might go way back, and I think I probably would go back to the Renaissance. I think an incredible Caravaggio would just be amazing. And I think I say that because I love what those artists did with technology at the time, the way that they adopted the techniques that were made available and transformed what I would say, you know, the course of art history. So to me, like, you know, those artists in the Renaissance period, Caravaggio and, you know, Da Vinci and all those artists, but Caravaggio especially, you know, the way he changed the way that we see light and the movement of light over the body. That, you know, it was revolutionary at the time. And I think that to me is exciting because it maybe is a little seed of what is to come now and how new techniques and new technology will unfurl a whole new raft of artists and opportunity. And that's what's exciting. Whatever we're saying today will look entirely different tomorrow. And that's what those artists did. So I think I'd reach back to them because that, to me, marks a sea change. And that's what we're seeing right now.
Love that.
What a great great kind of hark back, Simon. That was genius. That was lovely. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening.
It was actually quite literary. It was very, like, circular.
It was circular. Like,
beautiful, poetic ending to the show.
Yeah. So everyone listening, Simon underscore Oldfield on Instagram. Listen to go to our Instagram to see images of what we're talking about today. And then you've got all the other people we've been speaking about. Beeple.crap.
Beeple
crap.
I keep calling him Beeple.
I'm thinking of Beetlejuice. I don't know why I keep saying Beetle.
Beeple
crap on Instagram.
Beeple crap is his handle, but Beeple is
Beeple's his art.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
But there's lots and lots of artists there to discover. But I just say follow Simon and take.
Don't you think we should come back in in 3 months and see? Because I think things are moving so fast. I think we should revisit and check ourselves and say
But do you know what else I'd love to do is find more about where the women are in this, where the trans people are in this, and try and find some of those people as well.
But there are, and actually this collective Golden Town that I'm working with is all about that. It's exploring these marginalized groups and the fund that I'm working with. I've just been appointed the chief curator for this fund called Fortescue and Oldfield. Mm-hmm. And that is all about acquiring work on, to make it available for public exhibition. So we've already acquired some fantastic work. We've got some, Amoco Buefo and Bridget Riley and amazing things in the fund. Part of what we're looking at is, all these other new opportunities and how those, what those artists might, how they might fit into this collection, because what we're making possible with Fortescue and Oldfield is all of the artwork that's been acquired is being made available for public exhibition. So we're loaning the Bridget Riley's to a gallery in the UK for an exhibition in Bridget Riley's 90th year. Another one is going to the Yale Center of British Art in America at the end of this year. We're loaning the Amoco Buefos to another exhibition next year. And I think what will be interesting is to see how this world evolves, what we can acquire into that, and then make it available in many ways for, part of this bigger discourse. And I think some of those marginalized, underrepresented groups will be the people that we focus on in that. So, women and everything else.
Well, we will continue this wonderful conversation. And thank you for educating us a bit. I feel slightly clearer.
Oh, God, you're amazing.
A lot clearer. But I really appreciate it. And we will be back very soon. Thank you.
Stick around, Simon. Thanks, everyone.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, Simon.
Bye, everyone.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram @TalkArt, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.